This is a podcast from the Poetry Society.
We've been writing through one rotten kingdom for time immemorium. We've always been here just next to the story. As long as there's been soldiers, there's been poets. And it's a long, sad, venerable tradition.
Hello, my name's Richard Scott, and I'm delighted to be joined by the poet Peter Gizzi. Peter Gizzi is the author of many luminous and radical collections of poetry, including Fierce Elegy, Now It's Dark, Archaeophonics, and In Defense of Nothing, selected poems published by Wesleyan University Press. In 2020, Carcanet published Sky Burial, new and selected poems here in the UK. And in 2022, I was thrilled when Peter sent me and Andre Begu, my co-editor for the summer issue of the Poetry Review that year, his poem Dissociadelic. It's a poem which has really stayed with me through the months, so I'm so happy to be able to speak to you about it today, Peter.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to meet you.
I thought it'd be wonderful if you might kick us off by reading your poem Dissociadelic first.
My pleasure. That poem appears in my most recent book, Fierce Elegy. It's a small book, but happily Penguin UK is going to bring it out this summer. Okay, so here we go. Dissociadelic. To be a desperate player in the invisible world, this is something different. To have crossed over into ink and to loiter and bleed out on the occasion of the universe. I've learned this. My spirit broke long ago, so I won't be broken. This is something quite different inside the song. Blurs, gestures, something loved. Come as you are, collapsing and thriving with endings like beginnings. When Eight Ball says, ask again. When the day reveals the prismatic systems of loss, a blinding shimmer on new blacktop in a sun shower. Everything always in black, black wax, black dress, black hole, whatever. When you're brought to your knees, sing a song of praise. When you're gutted, embrace the whirl. FTW. There's nothing like it.
When you're brought to your knees, sing a song of praise. I hear something potentially transcendent in this idea. The speaker in your poem seems to be suggesting that when we're at our lowest, engaging with the idea of song, or perhaps the lyric, might offer some kind of wisdom or relief. The notional resonance of song is something you return to again and again in your poetics. Could you speak about its importance to you?
I don't know what to tell you, Richard. You know, the kind of raw desperation that this particular poem signifies and is that, you know, it's a frequency. The lyric has been with me my whole life, and it's been with us as long as there's been a human record. What I do favor about the lyric, and in particular the elegy, which could be the first form, is the idea that often it sings about fragility, right? It sings about impermanence. Nothing's here for that long. And yet this form, which speaks about intimacy and fragility and mystery and pain and also ultimately joy, has been with us for so long. It is such a durable form, and it's part of the meaning of the title of the book, Fierce and Fierce Elegy. It's a fierce form. It's gone through so many changes in technology. I think it's a very flexible form. You can do many things with it, and it's done many things to me. It's like, I don't have anything else in my life. Not to be depressing, it's not depressing, but I don't have a family. My family of origin is gone. I've seen them all through to the other side, being the youngest by many years. I'm alone and I don't have children. So there's a way in which finally in my life, the thing that's carried me all along is the poem, particularly my reading practice, others' poems that give me, quote, company, whether they're present or dead or long dead, right? To me, it's all present. Everything's happening now. And that to me is like an important animating feature to poetry, because it needs to be and create presence. You know, we all have this experience. You can read a love poem from the first century and it still moves us. And that's a beautiful technology. And yet it's singing about something often very profoundly intimate. I used to think that poetry was like one of the most resonant ways we have to understand the human record. But now, as I've gone on in my life, I kind of come to the fact that I believe that poetry is the human record. Because we've been writing through one rotten kingdom for time immemorium. We've always been here just next to the story. As long as there's been soldiers, there's been poets. And it's a long, sad, venerable tradition. All that intimacy, traveling down the corridor of millennia from person to person, that's our story. You know, the histories are written and then the empires are built and then they decay, they dissolve. Languages decay. But the thing that comes through is emotion. That is our story, that connection, that emotional reality that we must have in order to be here in some profound way. And I'm saying it's not without thinking, right? The beautiful thing about the poem is it's a place in where the idea of an emotional reality has a feeling intellect. It's actually a way to think about being here. And we're here for such a short time, right? The whole human record is not even the life of a gnat in the face of the sun. It's a majesty. It's just a mystery, the whole universe. And now all of these photographs and beautiful things that are coming back from space with the new technology and telescopes, it's all connected. You know, we're like in this ball of hunkin' metal whizzing around a star in this vast story. It's a mystery. We should celebrate it more. I think if people had that perspective, the world might not be what it is, but we don't have that perspective. That's the problem with power. It's very blinding and it's very bitter. It's a very bitter pill to have in your mouth. And the poem is a power in your mouth. It's just, it's of a totally different sort. It's kind of like a form of civil disobedience. And I could go into many ways how I think about that, but you have another question.
Well, there's also, to my ears, something ancient and intertextual inside the song. These blurs, gestures, something loved. And when I read one of your poems, Peter, I often feel as if you're balancing a sense of the contemporary, like the Eight Ball or For the Win, with something far older and paying homage to poetry's ancient lexicon. Words like spirit and whirl sing out to me as both being absolutely of your poetics, but also referencing Emily Dickinson and Gerard Manley Hopkins, for instance. Can you speak a little bit about how you choose your words and about the foundness of the English language?
You know, when I was younger, I think I wrote in front of myself. It was like will, right? I wrote out of will. But as you go along, you realize, am I speaking or am I being spoken? And I've come to realize I'm being spoken in the act of writing. Language comes to me, Richard. It doesn't come out of me. And that language is so much bigger and so much older than any of us. And the pronoun I does not belong to Peter Gizzi. It doesn't belong to anyone specifically. It belongs to everyone. We share it, right? To me, the I, the pronoun, is wound and sprung with so much consciousness and so much historical data, so many affiliated voices. You mentioned Dickinson. She's a perfect example of that particular way of thinking. That poetry, language itself, is a profoundly haunted medium, a dangerous medium, right? We haven't learned how to use it. Look at the world. But it's haunted. That's part of its power. So when I say emotion, yeah, that depth, that historical depth, is that, you know, people have been sorrowing all this time. I'm always consciously or unconsciously having my archive of reading speaking through me. It's companionable. They're there with us. And this is how poets act. You know, the idea that something falls from the sky, there's no single writer whose work has not come out of the experience of encountering another text. Yeah, anybody can write a poem, but being a poet is a much deeper, more complex position to occupy in a life and in a culture. And it has a very significant role to play. And so what am I meaning by that? The affiliated voices is that what poets do, one of the great intellectual, emotional connections we have is our deep, abiding love for another's work. That gives us wings. We bring these people back consciously or unconsciously. In one way or another, we bring their voices back into the world of light and speech along with ours. I'm just visiting this voice. What I write is not Peter Gizzi. Yes, Peter Gizzi is there, but I don't write autobiographical verse. I like being open to all of these tendencies, to all of these voices. I mean, that's kind of the majesty. That's why it's a vocation. It's a calling, a life. And, you know, it'll take all of you to write in a life. I mean, it will take all of you. It takes all of you to do this thing. It's definitely not a pastime. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I was very haunted by the word whirl in your poem. It's such a great and curious word. I mean, I took it to mean not just a pattern of spirals, but also the small wheel in a spinning wheel or spindle. And I was thinking, is the speaker in your poem asking us to embrace making or even writing?
Well, you know, the whirl is kind of an ephemeral thing. It's an action. It's in motion. There's that I like about it. It's happening. You know, it could be like a mesmer's twirling locket. And of course, right, words behind words, which is really what poems do, you cannot not hear world. Embrace the world, sure. But embrace the whirl because everything's whizzing. We know that all matter is in a constant state of change. That's the story. Everything is changing. Nothing is static. But the thing that remains throughout the universe is energy. Somehow we're animated by this particular force that is everything. We're animated by this, people have many names for it, but I'll just call it energy. And so whirl to me is an active concept of something spinning, whether it's tiny, a miniature, like you suggest, or the whirl of a galaxy. Like our galaxy is a spiral galaxy. It's turning. We can't see it, but it's turning. And, you know, I think of the whirls in animals' hides. Yeah, it's everywhere. It's both ephemeral and it's active. And that is the world, right? It's constantly changing. An eight ball, right? I'm not sure if younger readers know what eight ball is. I loved it as a kid, you know, the eight ball glass object that you shake and then you ask a question and then this little answer comes up on the bottom in the glass and the liquid, which always was like, wow, this is great. I hate Ouija boards, but I loved eight ball. My favorite one, which was so strange, is ask again. It was so like hilarious, right? It was just like this thing had consciousness. It was like funny. It's like, no, ask again.
There's also in the poem this notion of illuminating the dark or finding a way out of it, the black shimmer. I feel as if darkness is something you're also in dialogue with in your poetics. I'm thinking now of your poem, Now It's Dark, and the line, at least I'm writing and it makes a party in the dark. Can poetry reveal what has been illegible or darkly unknowable, a way out of the darkness that surrounds us, to paraphrase Robert Creeley?
My beloved friend, Robert Creeley of my life, somebody I loved and happily someone who loved me. That's part of the great experience of being in this world, the poets, my elders who I knew, and also the people who are happening now. But anyway, I'm glad that you mentioned Bob. The darkness surrounds us. And I actually really love that line. At least I'm writing and it makes a party in the dark. Yeah, poetry illuminates. That's exactly what it does. You know, it's like, yeah, the job is to illuminate a condition that otherwise hasn't particularly been revealed. What do we call that? The invisible world, right? A very simple way to think about it is you look out at a landscape and if it's not named, if it's not somehow given a feature, or relief, it's invisible. We don't see it. So what do poets do? They see things that are happening around us all day, every day, which is otherwise undisclosed. And then our prerogative is to name it. That's one of the, you know, majesties of poetry is to name things and to bring them into being, even if it's only for a moment, because poetry itself, while it's indelible, while it's durable, is also a very, very ephemeral art. Who really reads poetry? Poets, that's it. It's weird. I write for poets. I always have. I've always loved poets, you know, hence I worked on Jack Spicer, you know, for 30 years. It's something I favor. I tend to read writers who are just ahead of me. It's a bit of a struggle maybe, or a turbulence, or an unknown. And then you go on through your life and you become coeval with these things, like it's having a conversation with Wallace Stevens or Emily Dickinson or Jack Spicer. You know, now they're just company. But the work is still just ahead of me. It's like, you know, these close readings that people like to do, they have value. You can do some close readings of Dickinson, but that's not really what's happening. What's happening is she's created an atmosphere. She's created an environment. She's created a slippage. She's given us a place to dwell for a moment, a place to be held. How do we hold poems? Okay, we can do it with diction and we can do it with meaning, but we really do it, for me, is we do it with sound. We're actually singing. It's like sound before sense. It has to have a rhythm and it has to have a music or it doesn't interest me. Even prose poetry, right, has a rhythm and, you know, a sonic reality. But yeah, sound is very important to me. And I might have gotten it when I was young. My father was very devout. He was also a scientist. These two things were not at odds for him. You know, we'd have to go to mass. And I was happy to go because I got to be with him because I so loved him. But the mass was in Latin and the liturgy was in Latin. And when they started singing, I didn't know the words. I knew something enormous was being claimed, but I couldn't parse it. But yet I knew something was happening, and what was happening was rhythm and sound, a sonic reality. And so I didn't need to know the words. I got the meaning. You know, just like when you hear someone play a song and that, you know, instrumental music, it has a narrative. You get it. And I think that's one of the elements, that's one of the ways that poems work, is that sonic reality. It brings in another element of meaning that's, quote, sensational. It's like the senses, it's sensational. And I think that's also a part of this art for me. Yeah.
Well, now might be a great time to hear your poem Archaeophonics, if you'd be kind enough to read it for us.
Yes, I will. The opening poem of Now It's Dark, we could say Now It's Darker, is Speech Acts for a Dying World, which I wrote out of the condition of the rise of despicable Trumpism, like just terrifyingly depressing. I was also taking care of my brother who was dying of ALS every day, horrible disease. Very sad. So how do you write? So I got this poem, Speech Acts in a Dawning World, and that was the first poem, and that opened the book for me. The first poem in Fierce Elegy is Find Spot Unknown, which is when you go to a museum like the British Museum, which is where I first saw this, will be an artifact from 8th century BC, and then next to it, there'll be another artifact, but it'll say Find Spot Unknown. They don't know exactly where it was, how it was excavated and where. You know, they have a location, but they don't specifically know. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a great metaphor for a poem, right? An artifact of an unknown origin. So what does that mean? Quote, it's a real mystery. And that opened up Fierce Elegy. And then this poem, Archaeophonics, opened up this book for me. You know, I haven't written in so long, like, I don't know if I'm ever going to write again, but I need to catch a phrase. I need to catch a phrase. And the concept has to be large enough that it creates an enabling fiction, an environment in which I can then begin to wander. It's like an implicit meaning. It's like an implicit idea. And once I get it, Richard, the book comes. But who knows? Maybe I'll never get it again. I love the epigraph to Archaeophonics from the great, great, beloved poet James Schuyler. Poetry, like music, is not just song. Okay. Archaeophonics. I'm just visiting this voice. I'm just visiting the molecular structures that say what I am saying. I'm just visiting the world at this moment, and it's on fire. It's always been on fire. I'm saying this, and it's saying me. That's how it works, seesaw-like. The archive in the mouth, and the archive is on fire. That's the story. The sun in the body, and the body in the sun. It was like this, just like this. The world that's coming toward me, and the world around me. Around me are words saying this, saying fire, saying something, or all of it. That poem is a gift, yeah. Some of them are. Some of them just come.
Amazing to hear that. I've been so haunted by that poem. Like that line, the archive in the mouth and the archive is on fire.
When I say the archive in the mouth and the archive is on fire, I'm talking about all the fucking damage that's in language. All the damage that we have to take and bend. That's what I mean by civil disobedience. We have to take that violence in the language and bend it towards the light, given your idea of darkness and light. And so when I think of the archive, I think of that as well. You know, we definitely a personal archive, right? Bringing things back. But there's a poem in that sequence, field recordings. It's called Reverb, and it picks up on the poem before it. I hate how syntax connects me to shit. And that was the rich in the poem before. Because the poem ends, the syntax breaks down its mangled draft and says, one day the poor will have nothing to eat but the rich. I hate that when syntax connects me to the rich. Reverb. I hate how syntax connects me to shit. Or say the day is jeweled and burning, the fire's banking, and none of its letters produce the horror at the heart of the index. The old document hangs over the twin stare of murder and something else, that original slap of glove. The project is archival, all that blood in the mouth. The old language could have told you it's too late. We watched you die, watched you move through shocking losses and the solo flight you are taking back into the old language. It's the same, but different, different now. The mouth knows the bit, the taste of it. So that's another way of thinking about the archive, right? All that blood in the mouth, you know? And it's like, that's where we are with like, nations and peoples and races always dominating and killing and destroying one another. It's like these old arguments. It's like in my new book, Fierce Elegy, a long poem called Consider the Wound, you know, ancient wounds trickle fresh blood. These enmities, these grievances, they sadly have generations too and go on. They too have an archive. It's not just the beauty of poetry or art. This is the other corresponding archive that we also have to negotiate. You know, human cruelty and damage. I just taught a seminar on, quote, the psycho-political, showing them poems that are inherently political, and the poem is somehow bent by the force of the language that we need to sing in and give relief to some other reality, but it's psycho because they're not particularly explicit political poems. It's implicit, but it's there. I'm interested in that, right? I'm not somebody who bangs a drum. And yet, I'm always aware of this force that's always raining down us. The dangerous thing is, I love what Spicer says, words work mysteriously against those who use them. It's a very great admonition and one that's stuck with me. And always trying to unpack that throughout my life. If language was our friend, I don't know if the world would be thus. And then, you know, it does have this archive of damage and grievances and greed and power woven into the code, right? Because syntax connects me to my beloveds. It connects me to my dead, but it also connects me to Donald Trump, sadly. Can't really uncomb it. That's how I feel a poem like Archaeophonics is working, because I'm visiting this voice. That's the mystery and the majesty. But then within this voice are all these other forces. The world is on fire. It's always been on fire. And that goes back to what I'm saying about we've been writing through one rotten kingdom after another. This is what we do. But we bend it to another reality, a kind of feeling intellect. We've created a proper form to say goodbye. We've created a proper form to pronounce love. We've created a proper form to see the world with empathy. And this is what I mean about being a poet. Yeah, you can write a poem. That's not it. Poetry gives you eyes. It gives you a way to see. It's a gift of sight. And it really comes from learning how to listen. That's one of the great gifts of being a writer. I'll say poet in this instance, is like learning how to listen. And then you begin to really hear. And then through that, you begin to see.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, that line, I'm saying this and it's saying me, that act might not be entirely benevolent, channeling language. And if language is the dangerous code that we're talking about, then there's some danger in the act of channeling.
Yes. It's expensive to be a poet if you're really listening. It's exhausting. It's like bone bruising. If you have an historical imagination. You know, one of the things I really worry about the internet, I work with these brilliant young people. I have my whole life. They're achieving things I never could have done at their age. And it's a joy, but they have no memory because they've grown up with a prosthesis. They can just Google it. Like, they're very good in the last 5 years, right? But then some weird, it's like an ocean trench. It just drops off into oblivion. So it's like everything else before it never happened. The internet's really scary that way. It's like it's dangerously and thoughtlessly and cruelly just erasing time. Hence, history repeats itself, you know? We're protesting Gaza, as we should. It's horrific, but, you know, these things happen all the time. They're happening everywhere. And to have no historical memory is just not to realize this is the story. It's the master narrative, and it's a really dark one. And then I have to remind them that, you know, 11 million people in 2003 worldwide, unprecedented, never happened again. Worldwide, 11 million people protested the Bush administration to not go into Iraq. It meant nothing, did nothing, only emboldened them. You know, yeah, let's protest, but I'm just trying to give you a little perspective on these things. I do worry about what's happened to the idea of an historical memory with younger people. You know, I'm not dismissing them because I learn a great deal from them and they're beautiful thinkers, but it is a puzzle to me. It troubles me. I don't know what to make of it, but I'm just telling you, this is what I see.
I'm beginning to understand the world of that poem even more. The archive is on fire, the body is within the sun, the world is on fire. Things are incredibly desperate.
They're burning, yeah. Well, even in the poem Dissociadelic, I mean, that's a very expensive poem, right? Like, where was I when I wrote that? To be a desperate player in the invisible world, right? I talked about what I think the invisible is. To be a desperate player in the invisible world. This is something different, to have crossed over into ink and to loiter and bleed out on the occasion of the universe. The invisible world is many things. The thing I described about the objective reality around us, which otherwise is undisclosed, and then we give it a location and a name, as Shakespeare tells us. And the other piece is the invisible world we all carry within us. I mean, I have a line in a poem in the new book, which is, this is also about conversations with the dead, the only honest definition of silence. People lose people. This is what happens. And that's the thing they don't tell you when you're young. I have lost people profoundly when I was young, but they don't tell you as you get older. It just starts to, many people go. And we carry these people within us. Like the idea of the underworld, or what people call heaven, none of these things I believe in, is that like it's not over there like Halloween, some spooky thing. No, the underworld is inside of us. We carry the underworld with us every day. That's the invisible world. Those lost voices that animate our consciousness. Because if you've known and loved someone dearly and they're gone, you realize the conversation's never stopped. And in many ways, it becomes even more intimate. The conversation continues. So that's another way I think about the invisible world. Do I just sound like a crazy person? I don't know, but this is how it is for me.
And is it always possible to tune in? I mean, there's this amazing line in your collection, Archaeophonics. In my last rotation, it was hard to tune in. The dial was faulty. So what enables the tuning in now in response to a line like that?
The dial was faulty. Yeah, it was hard to tune in. That happens. Again, I find writing to be very expensive. It's like really hard work for me. It just doesn't fall out of me. It comes from a lived reality, this idea of sight, of seeing and seeing damage and being overwhelmed by the choices the human makes. So yeah, sometimes I can't tune it in. I didn't mean to go to all these deep, dark places in this conversation, but here we are.
And despite the desperation or the sadness that's being harvested or mined in Archaeophonics, if we go back to Dissociadelic, that line, my spirit broke long ago, so I won't be broken. The speaker refuses to give up. They won't give up the making, the listening. Poetry is a lifetime's inquiry, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything else. It's what I have. And without it, Richard, I don't know what I would be. You know, I can't imagine it any other way. And it was something I loved since I was a teenager, but you know, the idea that I would read a anthology in high school, you know, which had like Stevens and Pound and Eliot and William Carlos Williams and Mary Moore and other folks, but then, you know, a few contemporary poets, and one of them was John Ashbery, who just blew my mind. How could I have ever imagined at 16 reading this anthology that one day we would become beloved friends? Beautiful, reciprocal relationship. It's just like, wow, how did that happen? You know, stuff happens that it's pretty remarkable. It's what I wanted, and I guess here I am, for better or worse. This is what it is to do this thing. You know, I'm grateful for so many beautiful people that I've known in my life. Like Bernadette Mayer, who just passed away last year. Another close friend. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the great thing, poets live on, and do people read poets after they die? It's hard to know. But the poets who do read them are animated by them, and so therefore those people continue. If not named, they continue. That's an interesting piece of this job. Poetry has custodial duties, you know? It's part of it. You know, teaching's lovely. It has absolutely nothing to do for me with writing. You know, it's my civic life. It's over here. But this thing, the poetry, is something very private for me. And my poems are kind of private, right? But they're really not autobiographical. But yet, you know, it's like Gertrude Stein, anybody's autobiography. They are things that are relatable to all people. And I have this fantasy that I'd like to write poems that could have been read in the 5th century and could be read in the 25th century, if it ever exists. Because I do feel like it's all present. You know, it's like what Pound tells us is all time is contemporaneous in a poem. You know, many poets have this concept, but he was somebody I read as a teenager that taught me many things. This is before I knew his rotten politics. They also came out of the fact that he was obviously paranoid schizophrenic. He wasn't operating in some rational way. It's kind of like an illuminating thing. It's like, wow, if you really go into this thing, you could lose your mind. People don't want to read certain people. They want to cancel people. And yeah, but then we cancel the entire context, which that person came out of. All the moderns get low marks on many fronts, but they're in the groundwater, all of them. Everyone wants to believe when they lived at a given time, they would be on the right side of history. I don't know. Are we on the right side of history now? You know, can we find a patch of earth anywhere on this planet that hasn't been in some way contaminated by human damage? I would trouble someone to tell me where that would be. That's equally a part of who we are. And we need to own that in order to what? To, like, hopefully evolve. I don't have answers to any of these questions, by the way. They're just things that trouble me.
I'm wondering maybe if we might end with you reading another poem. You could read A Note on the Text.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of that one. A Note on the Text. The good poets defy things with their heart. This is how a fragment enters the people. Don't say beauty, say the beautiful, say the people. Say it is through chance that writing entered the people, their imagery and love of nature in glutted flowers, this place of fleshlessness. Here is my song, the only recourse of sun, even in its smallest syllables can be sown into the mouth. It is on the tongue the sun abides, two syllables fastened to each end to stretch the vocal pattern, its linen-like thread. That's a strange one.
I just love it. I mean, that line, it is on the tongue the sun abides, is simultaneously hopeful as well as kind of absolutely terrifying and clarifying, like the sun coming out of the mouth, the sun being spoken.
I mean, we are the eyes and ears of this vast, unstable, multiplying narrative we're all in, you know? I don't know.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this Poetry Society podcast. To find out more about the Poetry Society and how you can become involved, visit poetrysociety.org.uk.